It closed her eyes and hurtled away, far off into the distance, almost managing to forget that she could never move from the spot. And the fact that she had made her own decision to reject the offer of pardon lent her strength. What the hell? How had they ended up back here? Homer feverishly racked his brains for an explanation. Ahmed suddenly shut up when he saw where Homer was shining his flashlight.
"This station won't let me go," he said in a hoarse, low voice.
The fog enveloping them had grown so thick they could barely see each other. Nagornaya had slumbered while the men were away, but it had awoken now. The heavy air fluctuated subtly in response to their words, and vague shadows stirred in its depths. And not a single sign of Hunter. There was no way a creature of flesh and blood could win a battle against phantoms. As soon as the station was weary of toying with them, it had shrouded them in its acrid breath and swallowed them alive.
"You go," Ahmed gasped despairingly. "I'm the one at once. You don't know, you almost never come here." "Stop talking drivel," the old man snapped, surprising even himself with the loudness of his voice. "We just lost our way in the fog, let's go back." "We can't leave. Run as hard as you like. You'll end up back here if you're with me. You can break out on your own, please go." "Stop it, that's enough."
Homer grabbed hold of Ahmed's wrist and dragged him towards the tunnel.
"You'll thank me for this in an hour." "Tell my Gulia,"
Ahmed began. An incredible, monstrously powerful force tore his hand out of Homer's hand, jerking it upwards into the fog, into extinction. He had no time to cry out, he simply disappeared, as if he had instantaneously disintegrated into atoms, as if he had never existed. The old man screamed and howled for him, spinning round on the spot, as if he'd lost his mind, wasting clip after clip of precious cartridges. Then a crushing blow that could only have been struck by one of the local demons landed on the back of his head, and the universe imploded. Chapter 5. Memory. Sasha ran over to the window and flung the shutters wide open, letting in the fresh air and the tentative light. The wooden window ledge hung over the very edge of a bottomless precipice, filled with delicate morning mist that would disperse with the first rays of sunshine, and then the view from the window would extend beyond the gorge to the distant mountain spurs, with their covering of pine trees and the green meadows extending between them, the matchbox country houses scattered across the valley, and the cartridge cases of the bell towers. The early morning was her time. She could sense the approach of day, and always rose before the sun did, waking half an hour ahead of dawn in order to walk up onto the mountain. Behind their warm, cozy little shack, kept so clean that it positively gleamed, a stony track with yellow flowers along its edges wound its way up the slope. Crumbs of stone scattered downwards from under her feet, and in the few minutes it took to reach the summit, Sasha sometimes fell several times, bruising her knees. Lost in thought, Sasha wiped the damp breath of night off the window ledge and her sleeve. She had been dreaming of something gloomy, dark and bad, something that cancelled out the entire carefree life she had now. But the final traces of her alarming visions evaporated with the first touch of the cool wind on her skin, and now she couldn't be bothered to remember what had distressed her so badly in her dream. She had to hurry to the summit to greet the sun, and then hurry home, slithering down the track, to cook breakfast and wake her father, to pack the bundle for his journey. And then, while he was hunting, Sasha would have the whole day to herself, and she could chase the clumsy dragonflies and flying cockroaches through the meadow flowers as yellow as the patterned panels in the metro carriages. She tiptoed across the squeaky floorboards, opened the door a crack, and laughed quietly. It was years since Sasha's father had seen such a happy smile on her face, and he hated the idea of waking her up. His leg had swollen and gone numb. The bleeding hadn't stopped at all. They said that bites from the wandering dogs didn't heal. Should he call her? But he'd been away from home for more than 24 hours. Before he went to the garages, he'd decided to visit one of the high-rise concrete panel termite nests 2 blocks away from the station, clambered up to the 16th floor, and then passed out. And all that time, Sasha hadn't slept a wink. His daughter never went to sleep until he came back from his stroll. "Let her rest," he thought,
It's all lies. Nothing's going to happen.
He would have liked to know what she was seeing in her dream right now. He could never completely escape, even in his dreams. Only very rarely did his subconscious release him for a couple of hours for a visit to his carefree youth. Usually he was forced to wander through the familiar dead houses with their scraped-out interiors, and a good dream was one in which he suddenly discovered an untouched apartment full of appliances and books that had somehow miraculously survived intact. As he fell asleep, he always asked to be taken back into the past. He longed, most of all, to find himself in that time when he had just met Sasha's mother, when he was only 20 years old. And already commanded the garrison of the station, which all its inhabitants still thought of as a temporary refuge, not the general barracks for a slave labor mine in which they were serving a life sentence. But instead of that, he was tossed back into the more recent past, into the thick of those events 5 years ago, to the day that had sealed his fate, and, even more terribly, his daughter's fate. In his rational mind, he had accepted his defeat and his exile, but he only had to fall into a doze for his heart to start demanding revenge. Once again, he was standing in front of a line of his soldiers with their Kalashnikovs at the ready. In that situation, the Makarov pistol to which his officer's rank entitled him was worse than useless, except perhaps to shoot himself. Apart from the 20 or so machine gunners behind his back, there was no one left at the station who was still loyal to him. The crowd surged and seethed, growing larger and larger, swaying the barrier to and fro with dozens of hands. Then, at a flourish of some invisible conductor's baton, the ragged hubbub swelled into a coordinated chorus. So far they were only demanding his dismissal, but in another minute they would want his head. This was no spontaneous demonstration. It was the work of provocateurs sent in from the outside. At this stage, it was pointless even trying to identify them and liquidate them one by one. The only thing he could do now to halt the rebellion and maintain his grip on power was order his men to open fire on the crowd. It still wasn't too late for that. His fingers clutched an invisible gun butt. The pupils of his eyes raced about under his swollen eyelids. His lips moved, uttering inaudible orders. The black puddle he was lying in spread wider and wider by the minute, as if it was drawing energy from his departing life.
"Where are they?"
jerked out of the dark waters of oblivion. Homer started flapping about like a perch caught on a bright spinner, gasping convulsively and gaping at the brigadier with wild, crazy eyes. The massive cyclopean bulks of the twilight guardians of Nagornaya were still there, crowding together in front of his eyes, reaching out to him with those long, articulated fingers that could easily tear off his leg or crush his ribs. They surrounded the old man every time he closed his eyes, and they melted away slowly and reluctantly when he opened them again. Homer tried to jump to his feet, but the hand that was gently squeezing his shoulder turned back into the steely hook that had dragged him out of his nightmare. Gradually, moderating his breathing, he focused on the face furrowed with scars, on the dark eyes that glimmered with an oily mechanical glint. Hunter. Alive. The old man cautiously turned his head to the left, then to the right, afraid of finding himself back at the bewitched station. No, they were in the middle of a clear, empty tunnel. The fog that blanketed the approaches to Nagornaya was barely even noticeable here. Hunter must have carried him for almost half a kilometer, Homer calculated feverishly. Feeling calmer now, he allowed himself go limp, but still asked again to make sure.
"Where are they?" "There's no one here. You're safe." "Those creatures, did they attack me, knock me out?"
The old man grimaced and rubbed the smarting lump on the back of his head.
"I hit you. I had to stop your hysterics. You could have shot me firing like that."
Hunter finally released his vice-like grip, straightened up stiffly, and ran one hand along his broad officer's belt. On the opposite side from the holster, with his Stechkin revolver, was a leather case, with some purpose that wasn't clear. The brigadier clicked a button and took out a flat copper flask. He shook it, opened it, and took a large swallow without offering Homer any. Then he squeezed his eyes shut for a second, apparently in pleasure. The old man felt a chilly shudder when he saw that the brigadier's left eye couldn't even close properly.
"What was Ahmed? What happened to Ahmed?"
asked Homer, suddenly remembering and starting to shake again.
"He's dead,"
the brigadier said indifferently.
"He's dead,"
the old man repeated resignedly. When the monster tore his comrade's hand out of his, Homer had realized no living soul could ever wriggle out of those claws. He'd just been lucky that Nagodnaya's choice had not fallen on him. The old man looked round again. Somehow he couldn't believe straight away that Ahmed had disappeared forever. Homer looked at his own palm. It was torn and bleeding. He hadn't been able to hold on. He suddenly felt short of air.
"But Ahmed knew he was doomed,"
he said quietly.
"Why did they take him and not me?"
"There was a lot of life in him," the brigadier replied. "They feed on human lives."
"It's not fair,"
said the old man, shaking his head.
"He's got little children. He still has so much to live for. He had. And I'm just a wanderer. Tumbleweed."
"Well, would you eat dry moss?" asked Hunter, breaking off the conversation and setting Homer on his feet in one swift movement. "That's it, let's go, or we might be too late."
Trotting awkwardly after Hunter, who had moved up into a jog, the old man racked his brains, trying to figure out how they could have gone back to Nagodnaya. The station had drugged them with its narcotic exhalations, like some predatory orchid, luring them back to itself. They hadn't turned back at all. Homer could have sworn to that. He was almost prepared to believe in the spatial distortions that he once loved to tell stories about to his gullible comrades in the watch. But then he realized it was all much simpler than that. The old man stopped and slapped himself on the forehead, the reversing tunnel. A few hundred meters beyond Nagornaya, between the bores of the right and left tunnels, a single track line branched off, running off to the side at a narrow angle. It was for reversing the direction of trains. Feeling their way along the wall, first they'd get onto the parallel line, and then, when the wall disappeared, they'd turned back towards the station by mistake.
"Nothing mystical about it,"
Homer thought uncertainly. But there was something else he wanted to get clear.
"Hey!"
he called to Hunter.
"Wait!"
Hunter carried on marching forwards as if he was deaf, and the old man had to fight his breathlessness and pick up his own pace. Drawing level with the brigadier, Homer tried to glance into his eyes and blurted out,
"Why did you abandon us?"
"I abandon you."
The old man thought he heard a note of mockery in the passionless, metallic voice, and he bit his tongue. It was true, he and Ahmed were the ones who had fled from the station, leaving the brigadier to face the demons alone. Remembering how furiously and yet fruitlessly Hunter had fought at Nagornaya, Homer couldn't rid himself of the impression that the inhabitants of the station had simply rejected the battle that the brigadier tried to impose on them. Were they afraid, or did they sense a kindred spirit in him? The old man plucked up his courage. There was one question left, the simplest of all.
"Tell me, Hunter, back there in Nagornaya, why didn't they touch you?"
Several minutes passed in heavy, painful silence. Homer didn't dare to insist, until the brigadier finally gave him a brief, morose, almost inaudible answer.
"They couldn't stomach me." "Beauty will save the world," her father used to joke.
Sasha would blush and hide the empty plastic packet that once contained powdered tea in the breast pocket of her overalls. This little square of plastic, which against all the odds had kept its aroma of green tea, was her greatest treasure. It was also a reminder that the universe was not confined to the headless trunk of their station, with its four stumps of tunnel dug at a depth of 20 meters below the graveyard city of Moscow. It was a magical portal that could transport Sasha through decades of time and across thousands of kilometers. And there was something else, something boundlessly important. In the damp climate here, any paper faded and withered as rapidly as a consumptive. The mold and putrefaction devoured more than just the books and magazines. They exterminated the past itself. Without images or records of events, human memory was left like a lame man without crutches. It stumbled about in confusion and lost its way. but that little packet was made of plastic impervious to mildew and time. Sasha's father once told her it would be thousands of years before it started to decompose. That meant her descendants would be able to pass it on as an heirloom, she thought. It was an absolutely genuine picture, even if it was a miniature. The golden border, still as bright as the day the little packet came off the production line, framed a view that took Sasha's breath away. Sheer cliff faces submerged in dreamy mist, wide-spreading pine trees clinging to the almost vertical slopes, tumultuous waterfalls crashing down from the heights into the abyss, a scarlet glow in the sky, and the sun just on the point of rising. Sasha had never seen anything more beautiful in her life. She could sit for ages, with the packets laid out on her palm, admiring it, and her gaze was drawn right into that early morning mist shrouding the distant mountains. Although she devoured all the books that her father found before she sold them on for cartridges, the words she read in them were not enough to describe the way she felt when she gazed at those centimeter-high cliffs and breathed the scent of those painted pine trees. The impossibility of this dream world, which was also what made it so incredibly attractive. The sweet, yearning, and eternal anticipation of what the sun would see for the first time. The endless re-examination, what could be hidden behind the idiotic block of color with the name of the brand of tea on it. An unusual tree, an eagle's nest, a little house clinging to the slope where she and her father could live. Her father had brought Sasha the little packet when she was not yet five, and it was full then, a great rarity. He wanted to amaze his daughter with genuine tea. She drank it stoically, like medicine, but she was genuinely astounded by the plastic packet. At the time, he had had to explain to her what the naive picture showed, a generalized landscape from a mountainous Chinese province, perfectly suited for printing on packs of tea. But 10 years later, Sasha still examined her present just as wonderingly as on the day she first received it. Her father, however, thought the packet was Sasha's pitiful substitute for the whole world, and when his daughter fell into a blissful trance, contemplating this daubed fantasy by some failed artist, he felt as if she was rebuking him for her own meager, homeless life. He always tried to repress the impulse, but he could never hold out for long. Barely even concealing his irritation, he asked Sasha for the 100th time what she saw in a scrap of packaging from a gram of tea dust. And she hid the little masterpiece in the pocket of her overalls and answered awkwardly,
"Dad, I think it's so beautiful."
If not for Hunter, who didn't stop for a second all the way to Nagatino, Homer would have taken 3 times as long to cover the distance. He would never have risked dashing self-assuredly through these tunnels like that. Their team had paid a terrible toll for the passage through Nagornaya, but 2 of the 3 had survived. And all 3 would have survived if they hadn't lost their way in the fog. The charge was no higher than usual. Nothing had happened to them at Nakhima Prospekt or Nagornaya that hadn't happened there before. So the problem lay in the stretches of tunnel that led to Tula. They were quiet now, but it was a bad silence filled with tension. Hunter could sense danger hundreds of meters away, it was true. He could tell what to expect at stations he'd never been to before. But what if his intuition betrayed him down in these tunnels, just as it had betrayed many experienced soldiers before him? Maybe it was Nagatino moving closer with every step they took that held the answer to the riddle. Struggling to restrain his wild thoughts, which were churning rapidly because he was walking too fast, Homer tried to imagine what could be waiting for them at the station he used to love so much. The old man with the unquenchable passion for collecting myths could easily picture the scene if the legendary embassy of Satan had been set up at Nagatino, or it had been gnawed away by rats migrating in search of food through their own tunnels inaccessible to humans. Yes, if the old man had found himself in these stretches of tunnel on his own, he would have moved far more slowly, but nothing would have made him turn back. During the years spent at Sebastopol, Homer had forgotten how to fear death. He had set off on this expedition well aware that it could be his last adventure, and he was prepared to give all the time he had left for it. But barely 30 minutes after his encounter with the monsters at Nagornaya, he had already forgotten his terror. And beyond that, he could sense a vague, timid stirring somewhere inside himself, somewhere in the depths of his soul. Something was being born or awakening, the thing he had been waiting for, asking for, the thing he had sought for in his most dangerous expeditions, the thing he couldn't find at home. So now he had a cogent reason for struggling with all his might to postpone death for a while. He couldn't allow himself to die before he'd completed his work. The final war had been much fiercer and more violent than any that preceded it, which was why it had been over in a matter of days. 3 entire generations had passed since World War II, and its final veterans had gone to their eternal sleep, leaving the living without any real fear of the memory of war. From being a form of mass insanity that deprived millions of people of everything that was human, it had once again become a standard instrument of politics. The stakes had been raised too fast. There simply wasn't enough time to make correct decisions. The taboo on the use of nuclear weapons had been brushed aside in passing, in the heat of the moment. The shotgun hung on the wall in the first act of the drama had been fired after all in the penultimate act. And it didn't matter any longer who had pressed the fateful button first. Almost all the major cities on Earth had simultaneously been reduced to rubble and ash. Those few cities that were protected by anti-rocket defense shields also gave up the ghost, although at first sight they appeared almost untouched. Hard radiation, military poisons, and biological weapons wiped out their populations. The fragile radio contact established between the scattered handfuls of survivors was finally broken off only a few years later, and from then on, for the inhabitants of the metro, the world ended at the frontier stations on the inhabited lines. The Earth, which had seemed so thoroughly studied and so small, had once again become the boundless ocean of chaos and obscurity that it used to be in ancient times. One by one, the tiny islands of civilization sank into its murky depths. Deprived of oil and electric power, man rapidly reverted to a wild state. An era of stagnation was beginning. For centuries, scientists had lovingly restored the fabric of history from scraps of papyruses and parchments that they discovered, from fragments of legal codes and old folios. With the invention of printing and the appearance of newspapers, the presses had carried on weaving the fabric out of events covered by the newspapers. There were no gaps in the chronicles of the last 2 centuries. Every gesture and every utterance of the leaders who controlled the destinies of the world had been thoroughly documented. Then suddenly, in a single instant, all the world's printing presses had been destroyed or abandoned forever. The looms of history had stopped weaving. Few had any interest in it, in a world with no future. The broad fabric came to a sudden end, leaving only a slim thread intact. For the first few years after the catastrophe, Homer, who was still Nikolai Ivanovich then, roamed through the overcrowded stations, desperately hoping to find his family in one of them. When hope departed, he carried on wandering, orphaned and lost, through the darkness of the metro, not knowing what to do with himself in this afterlife. Existence had lost its meaning. The ball of thread that could have shown him, like Ariadne, the right path to follow through the endless labyrinth of tunnels, had fallen from his grasp. Pining for times gone by, he started collecting magazines that allowed him to remember a bit, to dream a bit. As he pondered the question of whether the apocalypse could have been avoided, he became fascinated by the articles and analyses in newspapers. Then he started writing a bit himself, imitating the news articles and describing events at the stations where he had been. And so it happened that Nikolai Ivanovich picked up a new guiding thread to replace the one he had lost. He decided to become a chronicler, the author of a modern history from the end of the world to his own end. His haphazard and purposeless collecting acquired meaning. Now he had to make a painstaking effort to restore the damaged fabric of time and continue weaving it by hand. Other people regarded Nikolai Ivanovich's passion as harmless eccentricity. He would happily hand over a day's ration for old newspapers, and at every station destiny took him to, he fitted out his own little corner, transforming it into a genuine archive. He joined the watches, because round the campfires at 300 meters from the station, stern-faced men started telling tall stories, and Nikolai Ivanovich could fish information out of them about what was happening at the far end of the metro. He collated and compared dozens of rumors in order to sift the facts out of them, then neatly filed the facts away in his school exercise books. The work was a good way of occupying his mind, but Nikolai Ivanovich was always haunted by the feeling that he was doing it in vain. After he died, the terse news reports collected with such loving care in the herbariums of his exercise books would simply crumble into dust without proper care. If he failed to come back from watch duty some day, his newspapers and chronicles would be used for lighting fires, and they wouldn't last long. Nothing would be left of the pages that had darkened over the years but smoke and soot. The atoms would form new compounds and assume a different form. Matter is almost indestructible. But what he wanted to preserve for posterity, the elusive, ephemeral substance that dwelt on the newspaper pages, would vanish forever, completely. That was the way a man was made. The content of his school textbook survived in his memory until the final examinations and no longer. And forgetting everything he had learned off by rote gave him a feeling of genuine relief.
The memory of man is like sand in the desert, thought Nikolai Ivanovich. Numbers, dates, and the names of secondary political figures remain in it no longer than notes written on a sand dune with a stick. It all gets swept away and covered over. Not a trace is left.
In some miraculous fashion, the only things that were preserved were those capable of capturing the human imagination, setting the heart beating faster, and engaging people's minds and feelings. The gripping story of a great hero and his love could outlive the story of an entire civilization, infecting the human brain like a virus that was transmitted from fathers to children over hundreds of generations. It was this realization that led the old man to his deliberate transformation from a self-styled scholar into an alchemist, from Nikolai Ivanovich into Homer. And now his nights were devoted not to compiling chronicles, but to searching for the formula of immortality. A storyline that would be as long-lived as the Odyssey, a hero with a lifespan to rival Gilgamesh. Homer would try to thread the knowledge he had accumulated onto this storyline, and in a world where all the paper had been squandered for heat, where the past was gladly sacrificed for a single moment in the present, the legend of a hero like that could infect people and rescue them from mass amnesia. But the mystical formula wouldn't come to him. The hero refused to be born into the world. Rewriting newspaper articles could not possibly have prepared the old man for making myths, for breathing life into golems, transforming invention into enthralling reality. Torn out and crumpled sheets of paper filled with uncompleted first chapters of the future saga, with unconvincing characters who lacked life, transformed his desktop into an abortion clinic. The only fruits of his nocturnal vigils were the dark circles under his eyes and the bite marks on his lips. However, Homer refused to abandon his new destiny. He tried not to think that he was simply not born for this, that creating universes required a talent that he had been denied. It's just the inspiration that's lacking. That was what he told himself. And where could he draw inspiration from in a stuffy station, locked into the routine of drinking tea at home and agricultural work? Even the watches and patrols were routine, and they took him on them less and less often because of his age. He needed a shake-up, an adventure, intense passions. Perhaps then, the pressure would sweep clear the blocked channels in his mind, and he would be able to create. Even in the most difficult times, people had never completely abandoned Nagatino. It wasn't really fit for habitation, nothing grew here, and the exits to the surface were closed off. But many found the station useful for staying out of sight and lying low for a while, for sitting out disgrace, or as a secluded spot with a lover. Right now, though, it was empty. Hunter flew soundlessly up a ladder that should have creaked obstinately and stopped on the platform. Homer followed him, puffing and panting, looking round warily. The hall was dark, and dust hung in the air, shimmering silver in the beams of their flashlights. Scattered sparsely across the floor were the heaps of rags and cardboard on which visitors to Nagatino usually spent the night. The old man leaned back against a column and slid down it slowly. There was a time when Nagatino, with its elegant colored panels assembled out of various kinds of marble, had been one of his favorite stations. But now, dark and lifeless, it resembled its former self no more than a ceramic photo on a gravestone resembles the person who had the photo taken for a passport 100 years ago, never suspecting that he was not just gazing into a camera lens, but into eternity.
"Not a soul," Homer murmured disappointedly. "There is one," the brigadier objected, pointing at him. "I meant—"
the old man began, but Hunter stopped him with a gesture of his hand. At the far end of the platform, where the colonnade came to an end and even the brigadier's searchlight could barely reach, something was crawling out slowly onto the platform. Homer tumbled over onto his side, braced his hands against the platform, and got up awkwardly. Hunter's flashlight went out, and the brigadier himself seemed to vanish into thin air. Sweating with fear, the old man fumbled at the safety catch and pressed the trembling butt of his automatic hard into his shoulder. He heard the faint pops of 2 shots in the distance. Feeling bolder, he stuck his head out from behind the column, and then hurried forward. Hunter was standing fully erect in the center of the platform, with an amorphous, wizened figure squirming pitifully at his feet. It looked as if it had been assembled out of cardboard, boxes, and rags, and barely even resembled a human being at all, but it was one. Ageless and sexless, so dirty that only the eyes could clearly be made out on its face, it whined inarticulately and tried to crawl away from the brigadier towering up over it. It looked as if it had been shot in both legs.
"Where are the people? Why isn't there anyone here?"
asked Hunter, setting his boot on the train of tattered, stinking rags trailing after the tramp.
"They've all gone. They left me. I'm all alone here."
The tramp hissed, scraping at the slippery granite with his hands, but not moving from the spot.
"Where did they go to?"
"Tula."
"What's happening there?"
Homer put in as he came up to them.
"How should I know?"
the filthy creature said with a crooked grin.
"Everyone who went there just disappeared. Ask them. But I don't have any strength for staggering through the tunnels. I'll die here."
"Why did they go?"
the brigadier persisted.
"They were frightened, boss. The station's deserted. They decided to break out. No one came back."
"No one at all?"
asked Hunter, raising his gun barrel.
"No one. Only one,"
said the tramp, correcting himself when he spotted the raised gun and shriveling up like an ant in the sun's rays under a lens.
"He was going to Nagornaya. I was asleep. Maybe I imagined it."
"When?"
"I haven't got a watch,"
said the tramp, shaking his head.
"Maybe yesterday, maybe a week ago."
The questions had dried up, but the pistol barrel was still staring into the tramp's eyes. Hunter stopped speaking as if his spring had suddenly run down, and he was breathing strangely, as if the conversation with the tramp had cost him too much of his strength.
"Can I—"
the tramp began.
"Here, eat that,"
the brigadier snarled, and before Homer realized what was happening, he squeezed the trigger twice. Black blood from the bullet holes in his forehead flooded the unfortunate victim's staring eyes. Flattened against the ground by the bullets, he disintegrated again into a heap of rags and cardboard. Without looking up, Hunter inserted 4 more cartridges into the clip of his Stechkin and jumped down onto the tracks.
"We'll find out everything for ourselves soon enough,"
he shouted to Homer. Ignoring his feeling of disgust, the old man leaned down over the body, took a scrap of material and covered the tramp's shattered head with it.
"Why did you kill him?"
he asked feebly.
"Ask yourself that,"
Hunter replied in a hollow voice. Now, even if he clenched all his willpower into a single tight fist, all he could do was raise and lower his eyelids. It was strange that he'd woken up at all. During the hour he'd been oblivious, the numbness had crept across his entire body like a crust of ice. His tongue was stuck to the roof of his mouth, and his chest seemed to be weighed down by something massively heavy. He couldn't even say goodbye to his daughter, and that was the only thing worth coming round for. Without following that old battle, all the way to the end. Sasha wasn't smiling any longer. Now she was dreaming of something alarming, curled up tight on her makeshift bed and hugging herself with a scowl on her face. Ever since she was a little child, her father had woken her if he saw she was being tormented by nightmares. But now it took all his strength just to blink slowly. And then even that became too exhausting. To hold out until Sasha woke up, he would have to carry on fighting. He had never stopped fighting for over 20 years, every day, every minute, and he was deadly tired of it. Tired of battling, tired of hiding, tired of hunting, arguing, asserting, hoping, lying. Only 2 desires remained in his fading consciousness. He wanted to look into Sasha's eyes at least 1 more time, and he wanted to find peace. But he couldn't manage either. Alternating with reality, images from the past started flickering in front of his eyes again. He had to take a final decision. Break or be broken, punish or repent. The guardsmen had closed ranks. Every one of them was loyal to him personally. Every one of them was willing to die now, torn to pieces by the mob, or to fire on unarmed people. He was the commander of the last unconquered station, the president of a confederation that no longer existed. For them, his authority was indisputable. He was infallible. And any order he gave would be carried out immediately, without a second thought. He would take responsibility for everything, just as he had always done. If he backed down now, the station would sink into anarchy, and then it would be annexed by the Red Empire that was expanding so fast, frothing over its original boundaries, subjugating more and more new territory. If he ordered his men to open fire on the demonstrators, he would retain his grasp on power. For a while. Or perhaps forever, if he didn't balk at mass executions and torture. He raised his automatic, and a moment later the line of men repeated his movement. Along the line of the gun sight he saw a raging mob, not hundreds of people who had gathered together, but a faceless jumble of humanity, grinning teeth, gaping eyes, clenched fists. He clattered the breech of his gun, and the line of men did the same. It was time, at last, to take destiny by the scruff of the neck. Pointing the barrel of his gun upward, he pressed the trigger, and whitewash showered down from the ceiling. The mob fell silent for a moment. He signaled for the soldiers to lower their weapons, and took a step forward. It was his final choice. And at last, memory released him. Sasha was sleeping. He drew a final breath and tried to glance at her 1 last time, but he couldn't even raise his eyelids. And then, instead of imperishable, eternal darkness, he saw before him an impossible blue sky, as clear and bright as his daughter's eyes.
Hark!
Homer was so startled he almost jumped and raised his hands in the air, but just checked himself in time. He was the only one that nasal yell through a megaphone took by surprise. The brigadier wasn't surprised in the least, huddling down like a cobra before it strikes. He surreptitiously pulled the heavy submachine gun out from behind his back. Hunter still hadn't replied to the old man's question. In fact, he'd stopped talking to him at all. To Homer, the 1.5-kilometer journey from Nagatino to Tula had seemed as endless as the road to Golgotha. He knew this stretch of tunnel would almost certainly lead him to his death, and it was hard to force himself to walk more quickly. At least now there was time to prepare, and Homer had occupied his mind with memories. He thought about Elena, chided himself for his egotism, and begged her forgiveness. He recalled with a luminous sadness that magical day on Tver Street under the light summer rain. He regretted not having made any arrangements for his newspapers before he left. He prepared himself to die, to be torn apart by monsters, devoured by immense rats, poisoned by pollution. What other explanations could he find for the fact that Tula had been transformed into a black hole that sucked everything into it and let nothing back out? And now when he heard a normal human voice as they approached Tula, he didn't know what to think. Had the station simply been captured? But who could grind several assault units from Sebastopol into dust? Who would have exterminated all the tramps who converged on the station out of the tunnels and not let even women or old men go?
30 steps forward,
said the distant voice. It sounded incredibly familiar, so familiar that if Homer only had time he could have identified who it belonged to. Could it be one of the Sebastopolites? Cradling his Kalashnikov in his arms, Hunter started meekly counting out the steps. At 30 of the brigadier's steps, the old man had taken 50. Ahead of him, he could vaguely make out a barricade that seemed to be crudely assembled out of random items, and for some reason its defenders weren't using any light.
"Turn out the flashlights,"
someone commanded from behind the ragged heap.
"One of you two, another 20 steps forward."
Hunter clicked the switch of his flashlight and moved on. Left alone again, Homer didn't dare disobey the voice. In the sudden darkness, he squatted down on a sleeper as far out of harm's way as possible, felt warily for the wall, and pressed himself against it. The brigadier's steps fell silent at the measured distance. Homer heard voices, someone interrogating Hunter in a voice he couldn't make out, and the brigadier barking abrupt replies. The situation was heating up. Tense, but restrained tones were replaced by abuse and threats. Hunter seemed to be demanding something from the invisible guards, and they were refusing to do as he wanted. Now they were shouting at each other, almost at the top of their voices, and Homer thought he would be able to make out the words any moment now. But he heard just one word clearly. The final one. Judgment. And then an automatic started stuttering, interrupting the men's argument, followed by the rumble of an army Pechenegg machine gun spitting a burst of fire in Homer's direction. The old man threw himself on the ground, jerking back the breech of his gun, not knowing if he ought to fire and at whom. But it was all over before he could even take aim. In the short pauses between the chattering of the guns, the depths of the tunnel echoed to a long, drawn-out scraping sound that Homer could never possibly have confused with anything else. The sound of an emetic door closing, confirming his guess. A steel slab weighing tons upon tons slammed home into its groove ahead of him, cutting off the shouting and the rumble of shots at a stroke, shutting off the only way out into the greater metro, severing Sebastopol's final hope. Chapter 6. On the Other Side. A moment later, Homer was willing to believe he had imagined everything. The amorphous outlines of the barricade at the end of the tunnel, and the voice that had seemed so familiar, distorted by the old megaphone. All sounds had been extinguished together with the light, and now he felt like a condemned man with a bag over his head, ready for execution. In the impenetrable darkness and sudden silence, the entire world seemed to have disappeared. Homer reached up and touched his own face, trying to convince himself that he hadn't dissolved into this cosmic blackness. Then he gathered his wits, fumbled around for his flashlight, and launched the trembling beam forward, to where the invisible battle had been played out only minutes earlier. About 30 meters from the spot where he had waited out the fight, the tunnel came to a dead end, cut off by an immense steel shutter that filled its entire height and breadth, like the fallen blade of a guillotine. His hearing hadn't deceived him. Someone really had activated the hermetic door. Although Homer knew about it, he didn't think it could still be used, but apparently it could. With his eyes weakened by all his paperwork, Homer didn't immediately spot the human figure pressed up against the wall of metal. He held his automatic out in front of him and backed away, thinking it must be one of the men from the other side who had been lost overboard, but then he recognized the figure as Hunter. The brigadier wasn't moving. Streaming with perspiration, the old man hobbled towards him, expecting to see streaks of blood on the rusty metal, but there weren't any. Although he had been fired on by a machine gun at point-blank range in the middle of a bare, empty tunnel, Hunter was unhurt. He had his flattened and mutilated ear pressed up against the metal, sucking in sounds that only he could hear.
"What happened?"
Homer asked cautiously as he walked up. The brigadier didn't even notice him. He was whispering something, but whispering to himself, repeating words spoken by someone who was there behind the closed door. Several minutes went by before he tore himself away from that wall and turned to Homer.
"We're going back." What happened?
Homer asked again.
There are bandits in there. We must have reinforcements.
Bandits?
The old man exclaimed in bewilderment.
But I thought I heard...
Tula has been captured by the enemy. We have to take it. We need men with flamethrowers.
Why flamethrowers?
Asked Homer, completely confused now.
To make certain. We're going back.
Hunter swung round and strode off. Before the old man followed him, he inspected the hermetic door carefully, and pressed his ear to the cold steel, hoping that he could listen to a snatch of conversation too. Silence. Homer realized he didn't believe the brigadier. Whoever this enemy was that had captured the station, the way he behaved was absolutely inexplicable. Why would anyone think of using hermetic doors to protect themselves against just two men? What kind of bandits would engage in long negotiations with armed men at a border post instead of simply riddling them with bullets as they approached? And finally, what was the meaning of that final, sinister word barked by those mysterious sentries? Judgment. There is nothing more valuable than human life, Sasha's father used to tell her. And for him, those were not merely empty words, not just some bland truism. But there was a time when her father didn't think that way at all. There were good reasons why he became the youngest military commander on the entire line. At the age of 20 years, you take killing and death far less seriously, and life itself seems like a game that you can start all over again if anything happens. It is no coincidence that the armies of the world were always made up of yesterday's schoolboys. And all these youngsters, playing at war, were commanded by someone who could see thousands of people fighting and being killed as no more than blue and red arrows on maps. Someone who could take the decision to sacrifice a company or a regiment without thinking about the torn-off legs, ripped-out intestines, and shattered skulls. There was a time when her father also regarded his enemies, and even himself, with disdain, when he astounded everyone with his readiness to take on missions that should have cost him his life. But he wasn't reckless, and his actions were always precisely calculated. Intelligent and assiduous, at the same time he was indifferent to life. He had no sense of its reality. He didn't think about consequences and wasn't burdened with a conscience. No. He never fired at women and children, but he executed deserters in person, and was always the first to storm the machine gun nests. He was also almost insensitive to pain. Basically, he couldn't give a damn for anything. Until he met Sasha's mother. She hooked him, so accustomed to his victories, with her own indifference. His only weakness, his vanity, which had driven him on against the machine guns, launched him into a new, desperate assault that unexpectedly became a protracted siege. He had never needed to make any special effort in love before. Women themselves cast down their banners at his feet. Debauched by their easy acquiescence, he always sated his appetite for his latest girlfriend before he could fall in love with her, and lost all interest in his conquest after the very first night. His relentless insistence and his fame blinded girls' eyes. And very few of them even tried to apply the age-old strategy of making a man wait until they got to know him. But she found him boring. She wasn't impressed by his decorations and titles, his triumphs in battle and love. She didn't respond to his glances. She shook her head at his jokes. And he started taking the conquest of this young woman as a serious challenge, more serious than subjugating the nearby stations. She was supposed to be just one more notch on his gun butt, but soon he realized that the prospect of intimacy with her was receding, and also becoming less important. Her attitude made the chance to spend even an hour together during the day feel like a real achievement, and she only went that far in order to torment him a little. She doubted the value of his accomplishments and mocked his principles. She chided him for his heartlessness. She shook his confidence in his strength and his goals. He put up with all of it, but more than that, he enjoyed it. With her, he started reflecting on things, hesitating over decisions, and then he started feeling things, helplessness, because he didn't know how to get close to this girl, regret for every minute not spent with her, and even fear, the fear of losing her, without ever having won her. Love. And she rewarded him with a sign. A silver ring. Finally, when he had completely forgotten how to manage without her, she yielded to him. A year later, Sasha was born, which meant that now there were two lives he could no longer treat with disdain, and he himself no longer had any right to be killed. At the age of only 25, when you command the most powerful army in the observable part of the world, it's hard to rid yourself of the feeling that your orders can stop the world itself from turning. No tremendous supernatural might is required for taking away people's lives, but the power to give back life to the dead is granted to no one. This truth was borne in on him cruelly when his wife died of tuberculosis, and he was helpless to save her. After that, something in him was broken. Sasha was only 4 years old at the time, but she remembered her mother very well. And she remembered the terrible, tunnel-black void that was left behind after her mother was gone. A gaping abyss, the closeness of death, opened up in her little world, and she looked down into it often. The edges of the abyss knitted together only very slowly. It was 2 or 3 years before Sasha stopped calling out to her mother in her sleep. Her father still called out to her sometimes, even now. Maybe Homer was approaching things from the wrong angle. If the hero of his epic refused to reveal himself, maybe he should start with the hero's future beloved, tempt him out with her beauty and youthful freshness. If Homer discreetly described her charms first, then maybe the hero would step out of non-existence to meet her. For their love to be perfect, he would have to be her ideal complement, which meant he would have to appear in the epic complete and fully formed. Their curves and contours, their very thoughts would have to match each other as precisely as fragments of the shattered stained glass panels at Novoslobodskaya station. After all, they also were once parts of a single whole, so it was their destiny to be reunited. Homer couldn't see anything wrong in approaching this effective plotline from the long-departed classics, but although the solution looked simple, there were still problems. Sculpting a living girl out of paper and ink proved to be a task beyond Homer's power, and he probably couldn't write convincingly about feelings any longer either. His present relationship with Elena was filled with the tender feelings of old age, but they had met each other too late to abandon the past completely in their love. At that age, people strive to appease their loneliness, not quench their passion. Nikolai Ivanovich's one true love had been entombed up on the surface. In the decades that had passed since then, all the details of her appearance, apart from one, had faded away. He couldn't have described the affair from life any longer. And in any case, there had been nothing heroic about that relationship. On the same day when Moscow was hit by the nuclear deluge, Nikolai was offered the chance to become a driver, replacing old Serov, who had been retired. His pay would almost double, and they even gave him a few days off before his promotion took effect. He phoned his wife, who said she would bake an apple cake, and then she went out to buy champagne, taking the children along for the walk. But he had to finish his shift. Nikolai Ivanovich climbed into the cabin of the locomotive as its future master, a happily married man right at the very beginning of a tunnel that led off into a miraculously bright future. In the next half hour, he aged 20 years in one fell swoop, arriving at the final station, a broken man, with no one and nothing. Perhaps that was why every time he came across a train that had survived by some miracle, he was always overwhelmed by the desire to take his legitimate place in the driver's seat, stroke the control panel with a master's hand, and glance out through the windscreen at the lacework pattern of tunnel liners. To imagine that the train could still be made to work. That it could be put into reverse. No doubt about it. The Brigadier definitely created a special kind of field round himself, a field that diverted any kind of danger away from him. And what was more, he seemed to know it. The journey back to Nagornaya took them less than an hour. The line didn't offer them any resistance at all. Homer had always felt that the scouts and shuttle traders from Sebastopol and all the other ordinary people who plucked up the courage to enter the tunnels were alien organisms in the metro's body, microbes that had infiltrated its circulatory system. The moment they stepped beyond the frontiers of the stations, the air around them became irritated and inflamed. Reality ruptured, and all the incredible creatures ranged against man by the metro suddenly appeared out of nowhere. But Hunter wasn't an extraneous body in the dark stretches of tunnel. He didn't trigger the Leviathan's resentment as he journeyed through its blood vessels. Sometimes he would switch off his flashlight, becoming just another patch of the darkness that filled the tunnel's space and seemed to be caught up by invisible currents that carried him onward twice as fast. Struggling with all his might to keep up with the Brigadier, Homer shouted after him, and then Hunter came to his senses, stopped, and waited for the old man. On the way back, they were even allowed to pass through Nagornaya in peace. The murky vapors had disappeared, the station was sleeping. They could see every centimeter of it lying open to view now, and it was impossible to imagine where it could have concealed those spectral giants. Just an ordinary, abandoned station. Incrustations of salt on the damp ceiling, a soft, feathery bed of dust spread out across the platform, obscenities scribbled with charcoal on the smoky walls. But then other details caught the eye. Strange scrapes left on the floor by some frantic scrabbling dance, crusty reddish-brown spots on the columns, ceiling lights that looked scraped and battered as if someone had rubbed hard against them. Nagornaya flashed by, and they went flying on. As long as Homer could keep up with the Brigadier, he felt as if he too were enclosed in a magical bubble that rendered him invulnerable. The old man was amazed at himself. Where was he getting the energy for such a long, forced march? But he had no breath left for making conversation, and in any case, Hunter no longer condescended to answer his questions. For the 100th time in that long day, Homer wondered why the taciturn and pitiless Brigadier needed him at all, if he spent all his time trying to forget about him. The foul smell of Nakhima Prospekt crept up and enveloped them. This was a station that Homer would gladly have dashed through as quickly as possible, but instead the Brigadier slowed down. The old man was almost overcome by the stench, even in his gas mask, but Hunter sniffed it in, as if he could distinguish specific notes in the Prospekt's oppressive, choking bouquet of odors. This time, the corpse-eaters dispersed respectfully as they advanced, abandoning half-gnawed bones and dropping scraps of flesh out of their mouths. Hunter walked to the precise center of the hall and up onto a low heap, sinking calf-deep in flesh. He cast a long, slow glance round the station and then, still dissatisfied, abandoned his suspicions and moved on, without finding what he was looking for. But Homer found it. Slipping and falling onto his hands and knees, he startled away a young corpse-eater who was eviscerating a soaking wet bulletproof vest. Spotting the Sebastopol uniform helmet that went tumbling aside, Homer was blinded by the condensation that instantly coated the lenses of his gas mask on the inside. Repressing the impulse to gag and puke, Homer crept over to the bones and raked through them, hoping to find the soldier's ID tag. But instead, he spotted a little notepad smeared with thick crimson blood. It opened immediately at the last page with the words, "Don't storm the station, no matter what." Her father had got her out of the habit of crying when she was still little, but now she had no other answer for fate. The tears streamed down her face of their own accord, and a bleak, high-pitched whine rose up from her chest. She realized straight away what had happened, but it took her hours to come to terms with it. Had he called for her help? Had he tried to tell her something important before he died? She couldn't remember the exact moment when she sank into sleep and wasn't entirely sure that she was awake now. After all, there could be a world where her father hadn't died, couldn't there? Where she hadn't killed him with her weakness and egotism. Sasha held her father's hand, already cold but still soft, between her palms, as if she was trying to warm it, trying to persuade him and herself that he would find a car and they would go up onto the surface and get into it and drive away. And he would laugh like the day when he brought home that radio with the music CDs. At first, her father sat there with his back leaning against the column and his chin braced against his chest. He could have been taken for someone in a doze. But then his body started slowly slipping down into the puddle of congealed blood, as if it was tired of pretending to be alive and didn't want to deceive Sasha any longer. The wrinkles that always furrowed her father's face had almost completely smoothed out now. She let go of his hand, helped him lie more comfortably, and covered him from head to foot with a tattered blanket. She had no other way of burying him. She would have liked to take her father up onto the surface and leave him lying there, gazing up at the sky that would turn bright and clear again one day. But long before that, his body would become the prey of the eternally hungry beasts that roamed about up there. Here on their station, no one would touch him. There was no danger to be expected from the deadly southern tunnels. Nothing could survive in there except the winged cockroaches. And to the north, the tunnel broke off at a rusty, half-ruined metro bridge with only a single track still intact. At the other end of the bridge there were people, but none of them would ever dream of crossing it out of mere curiosity. They all knew what was on the far side, a lookout station on the edge of a scorched wilderness, with two doomed exiles living in it. Her father wouldn't have allowed her to stay here alone, and there wasn't any point in it anyway. But Sasha also knew that no matter how far she ran, no matter how desperately she tried to break out of the torture cell she had been condemned to, she would never be completely free of it.
"Dad, forgive me, please,"
she sobbed, knowing that she could never earn his forgiveness. Sasha took the silver ring off his finger and put it in the pocket of her overalls. She picked up the cage with the quiet, subdued rat, and stumbled off to the north, leaving a trail of bloody footsteps behind her on the granite. When she climbed down onto the rails and walked into the tunnel, an unusual omen occurred at the empty station that was now a funeral bark. A long tongue of flame emerged from the mouth of the opposite tunnel, straining towards her father's body. But it couldn't reach it and retreated back into the dark depths, reluctantly conceding that Sasha's father had a right to his peace now.
"They're coming back, they're coming back!"
Istomin took the telephone receiver away from his ear and gazed at it distrustfully, as if it was some animate creature that had just told him a ridiculous fairy tale.
"Who's coming back?"
Denis Mikhailovich jumped up off his chair, spilling his tea, which settled on his trousers in an embarrassing dark stain. He cursed the tea and repeated the question.
"Who's coming back?"
Istomin repeated mechanically into the receiver.
"The Brigadier and Homer,"
the receiver crackled.
"Ahmed was killed."
Vladimir Ivanovich blotted his bald patch with his handkerchief and wiped his temple under the rubber strap of his piratical eye patch. Reporting soldiers' deaths to relatives was one of his responsibilities. Without waiting for the operator to switch the line, he stuck his head out of the door and shouted to his adjutant,
"Bring both of them to me, and tell the orderlies to set the table."
He walked across his office, straightened the photos hanging on the wall, whispered something in front of the map, and turned to Denis Mikhailovich, who was sitting there with his arms crossed, blatantly grinning.
"Volodya, you're just like some girl before a date," the colonel chuckled. "I see you're excited too,"
the station commandant snapped back, nodding at the colonel's wet trousers.
"Why should I worry? I've got everything ready. 2 assault units assembled. They can be mobilized in 24 hours.
Denis Mikhailovich lovingly stroked the light blue beret lying on the desk, then picked it up and stuck it on his head to make himself look more official. In the reception office, feet started scurrying about, knives and forks jangled, and an orderly held up a dewy bottle of spirits through the crack of the door. Istomin waved him away. Later. All of that later. Then at last he heard a familiar booming voice. The door flew open, and the opening was filled by a broad, massive figure. Hovering behind the brigadier's back was that old storyteller he'd dragged along with him for some reason.
"Welcome back," said Istomin,
sitting down in his chair, then getting up and sitting down again.
"What's out there?"
snapped the colonel. The brigadier shifted his dark, heavy gaze from one man to the other and spoke to the station commandant.
"Tula's been occupied by nomads. They've slaughtered everyone."
"All our men, too?"
asked Denis Mikhailovich, raising his shaggy eyebrows.
"As far as I can tell. We got as far as the entrance of the station. There was a fight, and they sealed it off."
"They closed the hermetic door?"
said Istomin, half rising out of his chair and clutching the edge of the desk with his fingers.
"So now what do we do?"
"Storm them,"
the brigadier and the colonel rasped simultaneously.
"We can't storm them,"
Homer suddenly chimed in from the reception office. She simply had to wait for the agreed time. If she hadn't got the day wrong, the trolley should appear out of the damp darkness of the night very soon now. Every additional minute spent here on the edge of the cliff, where the tunnel emerged from the thickness of the earth like a vein from a slashed wrist, cost her a year of her life. But the only choice she had now was to wait. At the other end of the interminably long bridge, she would run into a locked hermetic door that was only unlocked from the inside once a week for market day. Today, Sasha had nothing to sell, and she needed to buy much more than ever before. But she couldn't care less now what the men on the trolley might ask for in exchange for letting her back into the land of the living. Her father's chilly indifference in death had been communicated to her. Sasha used to dream so much about going to another station some day with her father, to a place where they could be surrounded by people, where they could make friends with someone, meet someone special. She used to ask her father about his young days, not just because she wanted to revisit her own bright childhood, but because she was secretly setting herself, as she was now, in her mother's place, setting some nebulously handsome man with shifting features in her father's place and awkwardly imagining love to herself. She worried that she wouldn't be able to find any common ground with other people if they really went back to the greater metro. What would they have to talk to her about? But now, there were only hours or perhaps minutes left to go until the ferry arrived, and she couldn't give a damn for the other people, the women or the men, and even the thought of returning to a human existence seemed like a betrayal of her father. She would have agreed to spend the rest of her life at their station without hesitating for a single moment, if that could have helped to save him. The candle stub in the glass jar fluttered in its death agony, and she transferred the flame to a new wick. On one of his trips to the surface, her father had found an entire crate of wax candles, and Sasha always carried several of them in the pockets of her overalls. She would have liked to think their bodies were like candles, and a little particle of her father had been transferred to her after his light was extinguished. Would the men on the trolley see her signal in the mist? Before this, she had always guessed the time right, so she never had to waste an extra moment lingering outside. Her father forbade her do that, and the swollen goiter in his throat was enough of a warning in itself. At the cliff edge, Sasha usually felt as agitated as a trapped shrew, gazing around anxiously and only occasionally daring to go as far as the first span of the bridge in order to look down from it at the black river flowing past below. But she had too much time. Huddling up and shuddering in the damp, chilly autumn wind, Sasha took several steps forward, and the crumbling summits of high-rise apartment blocks appeared behind the gaunt trees. Something huge splashed in the oily, viscous river, and in the distance unknown monsters groaned in almost human voices. Then suddenly their wailing was joined by a plaintive, dismal creaking. Sasha jumped to her feet, raising her lamp high in the air, and they answered from the bridge with a stealthy, slippery beam of light. A decrepit old trolley was moving towards her, barely able to force its way through the dense white gloom, thrusting the wedge of its feeble headlamp into the night and prizing its way through. The girl backed away. It wasn't the usual trolley. It strained its way along jerkily, as if every turn of its wheels cost the man working the levers a great effort. Eventually, it shuddered to a halt about 10 steps away from Sasha, and a tall, fat man wrapped in tarpaulin jumped down off the frame onto the stone chips. Demonic spots of reflected light danced in the lenses of his gas mask, concealing his eyes from Sasha. In one hand, the man was clutching an ancient army Kalashnikov with a wooden butt.
"I want to leave here," Sasha declared, thrusting out her chin.
"Leave?"
the tarpaulin scarecrow echoed, drawling the sound in either surprise or mockery.
"And what have you got to sell?"
"I haven't got anything left," she said,
staring hard into those blazing eye sockets bound in iron.
"Everyone has something that can be taken, especially a woman,"
the ferryman grunted. Then he had a thought.
"Are you going to leave your daddy then?"
"I haven't got anything left,"
she repeated, lowering her eyes.
"So he croaked
not, after all," said the mask, sounding relieved, but also disappointed. "And he did right, or he'd have been upset now." The barrel of the automatic caught the shoulder strap of Sasha's overalls and slowly dragged it downwards.
"Don't you dare!"
she shouted hoarsely, jerking back. The jar with the candle fell, shattering on a rail, and the darkness instantly licked out the flame.
"No one comes back from here. Can't you understand that?"
The scarecrow gazed at her indifferently with its blank, dead lenses.
"Your body won't even be enough to cover the cost of my journey in one direction. Let's say I accept it in payment of your father's debt."
The automatic twirled in his hands, swinging round with the butt forward, and struck her on the temple, mercifully snuffing out the light of her consciousness. After Nachima Praspiekt, Hunter had kept Homer close behind him, and the old man had no chance to examine the notepad properly. The brigadier was suddenly thoughtful and considerate. Not only did he try not to leave his companion too far behind, he actually walked in step with him, although he had to hold himself back to do it. A couple of times he stopped as if to see whether anyone was dogging their footsteps, but as the glaring beam of his searchlight was turned backwards, it always ran across Homer's face, making the old man feel like he was in a torture chamber. He swore and blinked as he struggled to recover, sensing the brigadier's sharp eyes creeping all over his body, probing him, searching for what he had found at the Praspiekt. Nonsense. Of course Hunter couldn't have seen anything. He was too far away at that moment. He'd probably simply sensed the change in Homer's mood and suspected him of something. But every time their gazes met, the old man broke out in a sweat. The little bit he had managed to read in the notepad was more than enough to make him feel doubts about the brigadier. It was a diary. Some of the pages were stuck together with dried blood, and Homer didn't touch them. He was afraid of tearing them with his stiff, tense fingers. The entries on the first pages were incoherent. The author couldn't even keep his letters under control, and his thoughts galloped in a way that made it impossible to keep up with them. "We got through Nagornaya with no losses," the diary stated, and then immediately skipped on. "Tula is in chaos. There's no way out to the metro. Hamza is blocking it. We can't go back home." Homer leafed forward a bit, watching out of the corner of his eye as the brigadier came down off his grave mound and walked towards him. The old man realized that Hunter mustn't be allowed to get his hands on the diary. But just before he thrust the notepad into his knapsack, Homer managed to read, "We have brought the situation under control and appointed a commandant." And then immediately, "Who'll be the next to die?" And another thing, framed in a little square above the dangling question, was a date. From the withered state of the notepad's pages, anyone would have thought the events described in the diary must be at least a decade old. But the figures indicated that the entry had been made only a few days ago. With long-forgotten agility, the old man's ossifying brain fitted together the scattered pieces of the mosaic. The mysterious wanderer seen by the miserable tramp at Nagatino, the guard's voice that seemed familiar at the hermetic door, the words, "We can't go back home." A complete picture began taking shape in front of his eyes. Maybe the scribble on the stuck-together pages could fill in the meaning of all the other strange events. What was absolutely certain was that Tula had not been captured by bandits. Something far more complicated and mysterious was going on there. And Hunter had spent a quarter of an hour questioning the sentries at the gates of the station, so he knew that just as well as Homer did. That was precisely why Homer must not show him the notepad, and it was why Homer dared to oppose him openly at the meeting in Istomin's office. "We can't do that," he said. Hunter turned his head in Homer's direction as slowly as a battleship training its main gun on the target. Istomin shifted his chair backwards, then decided to come out from behind his desk anyway. The colonel screwed his face up wearily.
"We can't blow up the hermetic door. There's groundwater all around. The line would be flooded instantly. The whole of Tula station is held together by no more than a leak and a promise. They're always praying it won't spring a leak anywhere. And the parallel tunnel, you know yourselves. It's 10 years since..."
Homer went on.
"So do we just knock and wait for them to open up?"
Denis Mikhailovich inquired.
"Well, there's always the bypass route," Istomin reminded him.
Astounded by that suggestion, the colonel started coughing violently and furiously, accusing his superior of wanting to cripple and kill his best men. And then the brigadier fired a broadside.
Tula has to be cleaned out. This station requires the extermination of everyone there. Not one of your men is left. They've all been finished off. If you don't want to suffer any more losses, it's the only possible decision. I know what I'm talking about. I have information.
The final words were clearly intended for Homer. They made the old man feel like a naughty little puppy dog being shaken by the scruff of the neck to bring him to his senses.
Well, since the tunnel is sealed on our side, said Istomin, tugging down his tunic, there is only one way to get into Tula. From the other side, through Hansa. But we can't take armed men through that way, it's out of the question.
I'll find men, Hunter said dismissively, and the colonel started.
Just to get to Hansa, you have to go through two stretches of tunnel on the Kakovka line as far as Kashira Station.
What of it?
Asked the brigadier, crossing his arms on his chest.
In the region of Kashira, the background radiation shoots off the scale,
the colonel explained.
A fragment of a warhead fell nearby. It didn't explode, but it's quite bad enough as it is. Every second man who gets a dose of it dies within a month, even now.
An ominous silence fell. Homer took advantage of the hitch to initiate a furtive withdrawal, tactical, of course, from Istomin's office. Eventually, Vladimir Ivanovich, apparently afraid that the uncontrollable brigadier would go off to demolish the hermetic door at Tula anyway, made a confession.
We have protective suits, but only two. You can take the most able-bodied soldier you can find, anyone. We'll wait.
He glanced round at Denis Mikhailovich.
What else can we do?
Let's go over to the lads,
the colonel said with a sigh.
We'll have a talk with them and you can choose yourself a partner.
No need, said Hunter, with a shake of his head. Homer's the one I want.